Bonjour.
What is a marketing strategy? What is the difference between marketing strategy and tactics? And who creates the marketing strategy and who is involved in the strategy? What does a marketing strategy actually look like? And what elements should a marketing strategy cover? And how do you change your marketing strategy? Loads of questions here, and I think this can be one of the most misunderstood areas of marketing. So I hopefully look forward to making marketing strategy more clear.
Let's find out.
The marketing game is about to change up. Yeah. Dropping something new and it's major. Everything that you need is right here. I'm talking marketing made clear. Go. Helping you to elevate from beginner to a pro. Ain't a better way. Marketing made clear. It's showtime. Wanna see you win. Wanna see you shine.
I love myself a bit of marketing.
So do I. Welcome to Marketing Made Clear. I'm your host, Will Green, and I'm joined by my assistant, Marketing Artificial Intelligence Technology, otherwise known as Mate.
What's up?
My aim, as always, is to make marketing clear, and each episode will dive into a specific topic, and today's topic is marketing strategy. In five words, strategy is about moving from chaos to structure. And when I was doing the research for this episode, I was thinking about strategy, and I can vividly remember being at uni when I was first learning marketing all those years ago. I mean, it's a while ago now. But my lecturers were saying about the importance of strategy. And I'm pretty sure the point they were making was about having a strategy as opposed to just conducting marketing activities without an overall purpose, like rudderless marketing or reactional marketing or just scattergun marketing. And if you're not familiar with these terms, well, I did just make one of them up, but scattergun marketing is about trying everything without any kind of focus, doing lots, but not really with an overarching goal or direction in mind. It's like creating content on the fly, deciding that you need to be doing social media, whatever that means, but not having a clear idea of why or what you're looking to get out of it. And that can include not having a process or a schedule for posting, even not properly reviewing marketing or analysing results. And it's also what I mean when I say rudderless marketing. But when I say that term, I'm talking more about the effects of scattergun marketing and perhaps the scenario when content creators and other people that are executing marketing communications are really good at their job, but they don't have that clear direction of what they're trying to achieve. As an example, gaining new customers versus retaining existing customers, or trying to increase sales of a specific product range, or trying to get people to purchase online versus in store, all of these goals have different nuances and require a slightly different approach. To me, strategy infers long-term thinking. Brands like Wish.com that set the expectation too high and then underdeliver, they're not sustainable for the long term. They end up rebranding and trying again, but consumers learn and they're not as likely to fall for the same tricks again. When we get onto the topic of positioning, which I plan to cover later in this season, I'll talk a bit about how brands position themselves differently for certain segments. Some don't and have an overall position, you know, like a divorce lawyer.
Yucky.
But they're quite specialised, so they have a single position. But a larger law firm will cover far more services like personal disputes, which includes divorce, family law for wills and stuff like that, corporate law, including debt recovery, real estate like conveyancing and so on. You're talking about a wide range of services for a wide range of potential customers. So the marketing strategy has to be far more diverse than that single divorce lawyer. You have individuals with emotive subjects like divorce or writing a will, but then corporates who are far less emotive and they'll be driven by other things like speed and success rate. Basically, it makes sense for the law firm to, at a very minimum, have a separate strategy to attract businesses, what we call B2B business, and individuals, which we call B2C or D2C. Each strategy should include reaching potential customers so that the right people know who the firm is, and then engaging the potential customers so that those right people then understand the benefits of doing business with you. Converting people, as in closing the sale or getting into business together, and then retaining the customers, as in making sure they keep coming back to you. So the overall marketing strategy will be very different in comparison. And before we move on, dipping back into other forms of strategist marketing that I brought up earlier, reactional or reactionary marketing. This is something that's very common. And you can argue that even companies that do have a strategy are too reliant on just reacting to what's happening around them. And while it's good and important to react to the environment, and yes, we should be doing a SWOT analysis, and keeping ourselves aware of the changing environment, and keeping budget aside for opportunities where possible, but I can't really think of a scenario where this is a good kind of core strategy. I mean, if you're always reacting to what other companies are doing, you're not in control. You're not working towards your own goal or objective, and you're just copying somebody else. It's kind of a moving goal, and how can you ever reach that, at least legally anyway? And you therefore can't measure the success of the activities that you've undertaken. So even if this method is successful in some way, because you've reacted to something else, how can you guarantee that those certain marketing conditions are going to materialize again? And that being said, again, I've seen some really great reactionary campaigns, ones that have gone viral, like the jokes that KFC made when they had a supply chain issue and ran out of chicken.
Bring me one of those chickens.
What's that, mate?
Bring me one of those chickens.
Sorry, I ain't got any chickens.
I'll still take that chicken.
No chickens here, just a bit of marketing advice and...
You're a talker.
I mean, it is a podcast, but...
Listening to talkers makes me thirsty.
Okay, this is starting to get a bit weird, so...
And hungry. Think I'll take two chickens.
Oh, dude, I don't have any chickens. Like, I don't know what to say.
I understand that if any more words come pouring out your mouth, I'm going to have to eat every chicken in this room.
Look, I'm really sorry, dude. I've only got marketing advice. Just, I haven't got any chickens.
Someone is.
I've got an idea. Let me tell you a little bit about Burger King.
The King.
Oh, come on, don't be like that. Burger King actually did a really funny campaign where they said,
why eat like a clown when you can eat like a king?
That's quite funny, isn't it? I even did it in a cool voice. Okay, he's gone. Let's crack on. Burger King also told people to order from McDonald's during COVID to protect jobs. Stunts like this increase brand loyalty to Burger King by 90%. And I've drafted a whole episode on the burger wars between Burger King and McDonald's, so I'm not going to go too much detail here. But my point here is that it isn't their core strategy. It's only part of their strategy. And this kind of opportunity doesn't always come up. For this to be part of a strategy, companies usually put a bit of budget aside that they can use if something comes up. But they would still plan most of their marketing resources around their core strategy. In fact, only this year McDonald's described their marketing strategy as maintaining a level of stillness, which they say grounds them. I understand this is partly because of being constant and a constant company. Love it or hate it, you always know what to expect from a McDonald's. This is all about consistency. Marketing Week reported that McDonald's
marketing strategy is fundamentally grounded in the business strategy
and the brand
keep honest to what is actually going to drive those growth levers.
They say
that are in our business strategy keeps us really grounded in terms of that prioritization. We are relentlessly curious about what happened in the market, what's happening with our customers, what are the drivers of business. We now know without a doubt that when we invest in work that builds our brand, it builds 1.5 times higher ROI in the near term as any other type of work.
Thanks, mate. You've saved my voice there. But to dissect that a little, they're focusing on the consumer, on consumer data, and they analyze ROI, otherwise known as ROI. Or return on investment. So they're in control.
Wow!
A marketing strategy is all about understanding your target consumers, understanding their motivations, understanding your competitors, understanding your objectives, and coming up with a plan to reach them. A company's marketing strategy is then to use all of this understanding or knowledge or expertise to create a mutually profitable long-term relationship between that company and their target consumer or consumers. And this is achieved predominantly by putting yourself in the best possible position to win your ideal customers. So before we get too much further, I want to take a brief dip into definitions. And as we've already covered the definition of marketing in the last episode, we'll just be looking at strategy.
Defining definitions.
Definitions.
So strategy. Here are four different definitions. Google defines strategy as a whole, quite succinctly, as
a plan of action designed to achieve a long-term or overall aim.
And I like that. I definitely pick up on the use of the word plan and the mention of long-term or overall aim. And even just action, the fact that we're actually doing something. It sounds silly, but there's a plan that's intended to be used.
Aren't all plans meant to be used, Will?
No, you get contingency plans, all that kind of stuff. Anyway, Oxford Reference defines a marketing strategy as
a plan identifying what marketing goals and objectives will be pursued to sell a particular product or product line and how these objectives will be achieved in the time available.
And obviously this is a bit clearer because it's specifically about marketing. Goals and objectives are mentioned, and it also mentions the time available. But if we're getting into that level of detail, we probably should include budget or maybe say how these objectives will be achieved with the resources available. It does just say product though, and obviously marketing covers services too. But at this point I want to say that when I say product, I mean products or services. But I just don't want to keep labouring that point, it will get a bit tiresome. But, Philip Kotler, Big Phil.
The most influential marketer of all time.
As I introduced in the last episode. Well, he defines marketing in his book Marketing Management as
the process to create, communicate, and deliver value to a target market at a profit.
But Kotler also hugely expands on this, and his approach to defining marketing strategy includes a lot more than just this one. Kotler's books are predominantly on marketing strategy, so you could argue that you'd need to explore that whole book to understand the definition of marketing strategy. If you go onto the website Investopedia, you'll find the definition of content strategist Adam Barone, who defines it as
a business overall game plan for reaching prospective consumers and turning them into customers of their products or services. A marketing strategy contains the company's value proposition, key brand messaging, data on target customer demographics, and other high-level elements.
Okay, so that's a bit more technical, but that's still cool. Overall game plan instead of plan of action. It covers reach and conversion, so turning them into customers. But he also mentions a few bits that we'll explore later, like value proposition, key messaging, and customer data. Adam's slippery get-out-of-jail-free card here is to add high-level elements, but it's a pretty good definition. If you ask me to succinctly define marketing strategy, I think it's important to realise that it's a top-level plan. It has to have some sort of goal, and it needs to include some sort of process. So I'm going to stick my neck out and come up with my own definition here. Here we go. So I would say that marketing strategy is a top-level plan that informs the marketing activities carried out to reach, engage, convert, and retain customers for a product or service with a specific measurable goal in mind. A marketing strategy should be discernible in offer to translate into marketing tactics with sub-objectives for the activity planned and some insight into the target audience and unique selling points for the company, product or service.
Very quick, very effective.
Thank you. But there will of course be some shortcomings with my definition because companies, charities and other organisations all differ greatly. But that's what I see marketing strategy as, and that's what this episode will be led by. Right, let's get back onto the core topic of strategy. And the biggest problem that marketers face, or businesses face really, is that we live in a very competitive world. It's fair to say that in most industries there's no shortage of goods or services, but you could argue that there's a shortage of customers, as in there's too much on offer, if you want to see it like that. There's a very real threat that this competitive landscape can lead to what many people in business call a race to the bottom. And by this, we mean that companies just undercut competitors, lowering their prices, giving stuff away, becoming less profitable by making less margin and ultimately going out of business. Marketing and marketing strategy is the antithesis of this. Marketing offers a way of selling goods and services in a way that's not about being the cheapest. Of course, this makes total sense, but you'd be surprised how often markets can end up in that scenario of the race to the bottom. And it just becomes inevitable that not all companies in this scenario will survive. I'd argue that what makes a company prosper is what's seen in its marketing ideas and offerings. All the other departments, bear with me on this, but all the other departments exist to support the company's offering to its customers. So I like to think of it as the whole company exists just to serve the marketing department. I'm sure not everybody, including some of my colleagues, would agree on that, but that's okay. But the marketing department exists to serve customers. And I'm sure my colleagues would agree on that, at least. But I would say that marketing shouldn't just be left up to the marketing department. And that's because a company should be consumer focused. All of the decisions should consider the impact on the customer. And this comes from the top management right down through the company. Because if top management aren't customer focused, the marketing department is going to have a really difficult job selling their products to customers. So if you think of marketing as the art of generating genuine customer value and not as a way to dispose of companies' excess product capacity, then you're on the right track to understand marketing strategy. Here's a poignant statement.
Oh, gone!
Marketing hopes to understand the target consumer so that selling isn't necessary.
Oh, I like that. Say it again.
Marketing hopes to understand the target consumer so that selling isn't necessary.
Oh, I like that. Say it again.
No, you get the picture, right?
Your choice.
Okay, so things have come a long way since people could just decide that they were going to make something or provide a service without a customer in mind. Remember that quote from Henry Ford? He's quoted as saying that Ford can do
any color the customer wants, as long as it's black.
I mean, that's a funny quote, but that just wouldn't be accepted by consumers these days. And gone are the days of the
book them and they will come
mentality. Although I do love Wayne's World too. And we see this change across various industries. It's like in the music industry, a band would only get signed if the A&R department can envisage a clear audience for an emerging artist. Usually the band would need to show that they have a clear audience by selling out shows or a tour. Unfortunately, artists don't just get signed for their musical talent. The A&R guy at the label has to feel that the music will be commercially viable, just as supermarket retailers will only stock a product that they know there's existing demand for. If they have to create the demand themselves, it defeats the object of their strategy, which is to sell all the products that people want under one roof. But people have to want them, so they're very selective of what they stock. There's a lot of attention to detail. In the last episode, we looked at the definitions of marketing, and I firmly nailed my colours to the mast supporting Philip Kotler's definition. Within the definition, Kotler talked about choosing a target market, and I will do an episode on segmentation, targeting and positioning. I've already promised it once. So for now, we'll just view this as the idea of understanding the core consumer group that your product is best suited to. Kotler's definition then mentions identifying needs and desires, and this comes from market research, obviously. But I think market research is a term that conjures up some idea of surveys or quantitative studies. But if we're talking about a startup or a smaller company, this may just come from a personal experience. Or it might be identifying a gap in the market that you feel you can do better than other people are doing at the moment. And then finally, in his definition, Kotler talks about growing customers through creating, communicating, and delivering superior customer value. And he doesn't mean value as in value range. Value may mean the product is more convenient, but the value for the customer might also mean that the product comes in a colour that matches their favourite jumper. So sorry, Henry Ford, you've just missed out there. Or that the quality is the highest possible. This is such an open-ended aspect that it makes the definition so widely applicable. And by stating superior value, we're saying that we're doing that better than competitors, which is potentially the unique selling point of the product. Where things really get interesting is that the unique selling point, or USP, is the most important aspect of the product to consumers. I'd label that something as customer synergy or something like that. It's really what we should be looking to achieve with a strategy. And strategies should be long-term and sustainable. A strategy that fixates on transactions today and a lost customer tomorrow is not sustainable. Stuff like Wish.com that I've already said about. A good strategy will focus on a mutually profitable long-term relationship between a company and a consumer, just like we said in the definitions section. So I'm thinking about a challenge that some companies have faced here. I think of high street brands that battle against e-commerce competitors that no longer have a physical premises for a customer to come in and visit. I remember the whole process of buying a pushchair when my wife and I were expecting our son. And I think of a brand like John Lewis in the UK, who sells a range of baby strollers and prams and everything, but as do brands like Mamas and Papas. And really, those retailers have approached this problem in different ways. John Lewis obviously has a huge range of goods, and so they know that by getting people to come and try out a baby stroller or buggy, they have the opportunity to sell that consumer lots of other goods. and then by offering click and collect or delivery at a competitive rate, they protect their sale and they can compete with the convenience of online. This all reduces the likelihood that people are just going to come in, try a buggy, and then buy elsewhere online for cheaper. But if you think of a brand like Mamas and Papas, they don't sell all the other products that John Lewis do. If you don't know them, they're a high-end retail brand that sell everything for new parents, like baby stuff, clothes, up to toddler kind of age, I guess. The threat is so much higher for people to come in and try a buggy and then buy it online elsewhere. So their strategy has been to ensure that they offer extremely high quality goods for all of babies' needs, not just the high ticket items of car seats and strollers. They offer the best customer service available. And as a new parent, it's a highly kind of emotive period and quite frankly, quite scary. So they have their high quality own brand goods that aren't available elsewhere and they can't be bought for cheaper elsewhere online. Because their customer service is so good, existing customers feel comfortable going back to the shop for further advice, which then helps them to retain customers, and it creates that profitable long-term relationship that we just mentioned. So that's one fairly clear strategy that we can see in that place. And Mamas and Papas were formed in 1981, which was way before the internet boom and the decline of the high streets. So this strategy is part of their adaptation. In the last episode, I said that it's really important for marketers and companies to adapt or die. I think it's important to reiterate that point. I would say that if you want to be a marketer, the good news is that I think marketing will be around forever. But the bad news is that marketing won't be the way you learnt it. So,
adapt or die.
It's your choice.
Your choice.
There's a few other bits that I want to cover before moving on, come to think of it. I think it would be better over a little bit of music, so I just put this together. Here you go. So first, I must acknowledge the difference between a marketing strategy and a plan. And yes, they're closely related. But stop, because they refer to different aspects of the overall marketing process. And we've defined what a strategy is as an overarching approach or broader direction taken to achieve given objectives. So it's more of a concept. Or a top-level guide. But marketing plan is like a roadmap.
It's a little bit like a roadmap.
And it outlines the specific marketing activities, tactics and actions that will be implemented over a specified time. And they'll achieve the goals set out by the marketing strategy. Plans must be represented by detailing specific steps, tasks or campaigns and initiatives that put their strategy into action.
Put it into action.
There will be more detail in the plan about campaigns, promotional activities, budget, timelines, marketing channels, and most likely more granular or detailed kind of metrics for measuring success. A marketing plan is operational. Some say it's sensational. You could say a marketing plan is more practical for the employees within a company to work with, where a strategy is set at the top level of a company. Yes, yes, oh yay. I'm terribly sorry, I don't know what came over me there. I think I'll have to do this next bit without music because I just get a bit carried away. And that is to talk about marketing strategy versus marketing tactics. Another thing that takes me back to my university days is the discussion and relationship between strategy and tactics. Now here's a quote for you, and brace yourself. In the art of war, Sun Tzu emphasizes the crucial relationship between strategy and tactics, stating,
"我所取胜的战术，所有人都看得见，但胜利的谋略却无人能见."
And that translates as,
"All men can see the tactics whereby I conquer, but what none can see is the strategy out of which victory is evolved."
Sun Tzu illustrates that while tactics are visible and concrete, a comprehensive strategy is equally essential and it guides the implementation of tactics. It's not a matter of strategy versus tactics, but rather tactics led by a strategy. Two interdependent elements necessary for achieving goals. Relying solely on strategy without employing tactics leads nowhere. Tactics are the actionable steps that propel progress. If a team focuses solely on strategy, they are just planning rather than executing the necessary actions to achieve their goals. Like I said earlier, these plans are actually made to be carried out. Along the same lines, pursuing business goals solely with tactics doesn't lead anywhere. Tactics devoid of strategy become random actions, lacking in strategic purpose. So the rudderless or directionless marketing that I was talking about in the start of the episode. Initially, this may seem productive, but in the long run, it's much more likely to fail than tactics driven by strategy.
What is a marketing strategy anyway, William?
Oh, don't call me William. I feel like I'm in trouble. But yeah, what is marketing strategy? When we talk about a marketing strategy, there isn't really a given format for a strategy. If a template existed, then I very much doubt it would be truly usable for the majority of companies. There's no one-size-fits-all.
Follow those size fives.
I mean, there are so many different industries with their own dynamics, nuances, consumer demands and segments. How can one approach strategy fit it all?
It can't.
Exactly.
It can't.
Yeah. I'm going to begrudgingly mention there's seven P's here again.
P, 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 P.
As you might have been able to tell from the last episode, I bring these up with caution. And it does tie into strategy as to why I'm cautious with them. Traditionally, the seven P's were actually the four P's: product, price, place, and promotion. But packaging was argued as a fifth P by perfume companies, and you can understand why. I mean, packaging forms such an important part of marketing something like a perfume or an inexpensive whiskey or rum. But the counter argument from the people that wanted to protect the four P's, I don't know who they are, but okay. But the counter-argument is that packaging is part of product, so packaging isn't one of the seven Ps. And then later arguments have also been made to include the sales force, but this was considered promotion, and a promotion tool along with other elements like advertising, public relations, and the use of other marketing channels. Service-based companies argued that service should be included, but this was again argued to be part of the product. But then the accepted additional P's become personnel or people, which includes Salesforce, then procedures and physical evidence. An example given where these come into play is how a restaurant's performance will depend on its staff, the process by which it serves food, for example, fast food, takeaway, buffet or delivery, and then its physical looks and features as a restaurant. Other suggestions of additions of the four P's include personalization, politics, and public relations. These were suggested because they also influence a company's ability to sell. And I'm coming to a point with this strategy, please bear with me.
Thank goodness.
All right. But the criticism of using this model is namely that it represents the seller's mindset and not the buyer's mindset. And what we mean by that is that we're talking about the different aspects of a company from the company's perspective. But how are you meant to be consumer-focused if you're using a model that doesn't revolve around the consumer? You have to find out what areas of the seven Ps are most important for the consumer. I can tell you from experience and from various studies that I've conducted that in the field of dog food, product quality, price, and convenience are the most important aspects from a consumer perspective. These are different aspects, and it doesn't matter how you categorize them and whether they fall under product, price, or any of the other Ps. And you could spend a lot of time debating whether convenience comes under product, place, or even process. But you'd be getting away from spending time and focusing on the real understanding of what the consumer actually wants. So to put this into a strategic sense, a company wanting to focus on strategy that places product quality, price, and convenience at its heart will still have to determine the extent to which all three of the elements are prioritized. Because some of these are mutually exclusive. In most cases, it's not possible to make a quality product that's convenient to the consumer and for a low price, or for the lowest price at least. Competitors may choose to prioritize one of these three elements. For example, prioritizing convenience so that they become known as the convenient brand. That could be done by offering subscriptions or convenient pack sizes. Another competitor may prioritize one element of product quality, such as nutrition, so that they become known as the most nutritious brand. Whereas another company may target ethical sourcing, which could be considered underneath the umbrella of quality, and become known as the brand with the most ethically sourced ingredients. I find all this very interesting, having come from a product manufacturer background, with many years in the paper industry.
Boring.
Well, it's not actually that boring.
Okay, mate.
It's a giant industry, and if you want to get into an industry where marketing really has to add value, that is it. But my point is that in some cases, the same products can be known for different things. For instance, The paper manufacturer I worked for used to white label goods for other companies. And by white label, I mean manufacture other people's product for them. And in the UK, the same paper would be sold under four different brand names, or even more sometimes, all focusing on different elements or different USPs, charged a different price. But it was the exact same paper. And the companies selling the paper were not making any false claims. They were simply choosing to focus on one element of the paper specification as a USP rather than another. So one company might focus on brightness or whiteness of the paper, whereas another company would focus on how well it prints with a specific machine, like a certain type of HB printer, or the dynamic stiffness of the paper that makes it great for cards. And paper is a very specification-driven commodity, so there are many different ways that this can be done. But other paper products that are also identical, marketed based on more emotional and less rational drivers, like linking them to a charity or having a cute dog on the packaging.
Oh, look at that doggy. It's so cute.
This goes back to what I was saying in the last episode about some consumers being driven to purchase products based on fashion drivers, latest trends, or even nostalgia. The way to select a winning strategy is to find the driver that consumers relate to, and I would assume not all consumers are going to be driven by the same thing. So that's where segmentation comes in, and you'd focus your strategy to appeal to the segment that you're targeting. And again, this might be the same product, but marketed differently. A big part of the strategy is to understand the product lifecycle. And there's some real general rules here when it comes to setting strategies at different parts of the product lifecycle. One example is it's a good idea to focus on reach in the early stages of a product lifecycle. And by that, I mean to reach people, help them understand your company or product. The best channels for reach are usually PR, so get working on press coverage or other media coverage, and through advertising, whether that is digital or traditional. And the aim is reaching as many relevant people as possible, and the emphasis is really on relevant people. In later product life stages, it's usually best to focus on sales promotions, which create that urgency, and they temporarily make your product more competitive price-wise, whilst it also allows you to reduce your marketing budget a bit. And there is a kind of swing there, it's a pendulum effect against, you know, putting your focus on dropping the price or being price competitive, and then keeping your price higher, but then spending more on marketing. Personal selling is also highly recommended, which helps strengthen customers' understanding of your offers and benefits. And this is about trying to stop customers from changing their consumer behaviour. In other words, building loyalty or making the purchase of your products habitual. And on this, you could say that you're trying to get customers to understand all of your USPs, rather than just the top level. Obviously, another influence on the choice of advertising type or channels is the company size. Larger market leaders can afford more advertising, and by that I mean mass media marketing, like TV, radio, Google, Facebook, and other channels that reach the widest base of consumers. The larger market leaders tend to use sales promotions less, which often helps maintain profitability by maintaining margin. So smaller companies in general will use sales promotions more aggressively. But these are generalizations. And talking of generalizations, I'd like to give a nod here to Porter's three generic competitive strategies.
Porter's three generic competitive strategies.
So if you don't know who Michael Eugene Porter is, he's an American academic known for theories on economics, business strategy, and social causes. He created Porter's Five Forces, which is a really good tool for analysing business. He's regarded as the father of the modern strategy field. And when you start learning business or anything like that, you do come across Porter quite a lot. It is sometimes kind of introductory level, so we take it with a pinch of salt, just like with the seven P's and all that, but it is worth giving a nod to.
What? Giving a nod to? I think that stops an approach.
No, giving a nod to, like, you know, acknowledging it.
Oh, okay.
Personally, I feel that there are so many different types of strategies that are open to an organization. You could say it's infinite, but there is a train of thought that suggests that you can categorize everything into three predominant types of strategy. And in 1980, Michael Eugene Porter, an academic known for his theories on economics, business strategy, and social causes, argued that overall cost leadership, differentiation, or focus were the three key areas that provide a meaningful basis for strategic thinking. So that's overall cost leadership, differentiation, and focus. And his argument is that whatever you do, you would roughly base your strategy on one of these. So what does this all mean?
And say, children, what does it all mean?
Well, these are very generic terms. But as a cost leader, you would lean on economies of scale while selling to the largest possible market and generating the greatest efficiencies. I'd argue that this puts less strain on intelligent marketing and more strain on the wider business to achieve these efficiencies. The examples of cost leaders are Walmart in America, although convenience plays a huge factor there as they have everything under one roof. McDonald's, again, convenience and clear expectations play a huge part. But Ryanair is a really good example, so they're very focused on cost. Then differentiation involves creating brand identity and constantly pursuing factors which customers perceive to be important. Differentiation also goes hand in hand with innovation and offering higher service levels. I think that because I've worked on a lot of premium markets, I'm predisposed to focus on differentiation when I'm kind of planning my strategies. But you could argue that differentiation is important whatever your strategy, because otherwise you're leaving yourself open to the risk of another company doing what you can do, but cheaper. Differentiation can be based on just one element or a couple, but it clearly has to be something that customers value, otherwise they won't care if you're different.
It's like the Crisp Company saying, we're the only company that adds a free condom in each pack of crisps.
Okay, I guess that works as an analogy. But Apple, Lush, and most premium brands use differentiation in their strategy. And finally, focus, which involves concentrating upon one or small groups of segments. And this involves creating a strong and specialist reputation. And obviously to do this, you have to have a very clear understanding of your target audience. It involves making decisions that might make your product less appealing to other segments, or even excluding them altogether. And there's two variants of this. So there's cost focus and differentiation focus. So it does kind of lean on the other elements too. But with a cost focus, rather than a cost leader, you're focusing on being the cost leader in a specific segment rather than for the whole market. I think you could use IKEA as an example here, because I don't think you could say that their total focus is on somebody like Ryanair, you know, the kind of way that they focus just on cost. They design their products for efficient manufacturing and the whole flat pack packaging approach. They're self-service, which means their stores are fairly unique, which is a really large part of their unique offer. But then with differentiation focus, you're focusing on being the differentiation leader in a specific segment rather than for the whole market. You have to consider that that target segment is different. It has different needs to the wider market. Otherwise, you would just be using the wider differentiation strategy. It's a bit more tricky to think of examples here because of their nature, or by their nature, I would think that they're smaller companies. But for dog food, which I know very well, you could say that a raw dog food company who focuses on sustainability would be utilizing differentiation focus. That's because they might not be the most environmentally friendly kind of food overall for dogs, but you could argue that a vegetarian diet is the most environmentally friendly way to feed your dog, but that would be widely frowned upon for being unsuitable for dogs who are largely carnivores. And there's a strong segment of raw feeders who feed this for nutritional benefits. They make up 15 to 20% of the dog food market, but by differentiating themselves as the environmental leader in that segment of raw dog food, they're targeting the customers within that 15 to 20% that are driven by the environmental and sustainability concerns. So that's the three strategies. The next bit I'd like to talk about is SWOT. So S-W-O-T, a SWOT analysis. And a lot of the aspects of strategy that I've already said, they rely on the understanding of your target customer. But it's also really important to understand the market as a whole, more specifically the market that the company is competing in. I mean, if your strategy is to be the cheapest, or to be the best at something, how do you know that you will be unless you've done your research? And this kind of research is usually structured in the form of a SWOT analysis. So this is looking at strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. With all of these kind of generic models...
Generic models.
Hi, my name is Ivy. And even though I'm a model, I believe that beauty is only skin deep. I mean, have you seen the inside of a body? It's disgusting.
No, not that kind of generic model. Come on. Anyway, a SWOT analysis offers a framework to help you consider as many relevant factors as possible. And this includes both internal and external factors. So when you see a SWOT analysis and it only covers the company and not the wider environment, that's not what you're looking for here. But for strengths, strengths can include factors such as a strong brand reputation, a large database of customers, social media accounts with a large following, or more company-wide points like unique technology, a talented workforce, or efficient processes. For the cost leader strategy, strengths would need to include efficiency and other things like economies of scale. But for differentiation, you would expect to see that element reflected in strengths section like quality, supply chain, or specific product characteristics. Then weaknesses include internal factors that may hinder or prove a challenge to achieving objectives. So weaknesses could include like a small budget, inadequate infrastructure, lack of skilled personnel, or marketing specific, it would be the opposite to strengths. So small databases or a small social following, a poor brand reputation or poor market positioning. With opportunities, we're talking about external factors or situations that could be leveraged to the organization's advantage. So opportunities could come from market trends, changes in consumer behavior, technological advancements, or favorable government policies. You think about what an opportunity COVID was for companies, offering online meetings, couriers, or fast food deliveries, or, you know, protective equipment. Threats tend to be external factors that could potentially cause trouble or challenges in the organization. Threats may come from competitors, economic downturns, regulation changes, or disruptive technologies, or even shifts in customer preference. But sometimes we can turn a threat into an opportunity. So you might identify economic downturn as a threat to a premium brand. But you could argue that it also offers an opportunity for that brand to diversify into a more affordable range or offering. I think we've seen this a lot recently with high-end retailers are offering more affordable ranges. Alternatively, premium companies can emotively lean on the need to treat yourself when times are hard, positioning themselves as a bit of escapism. These are both strong strategies, but doing nothing or not having a plan for the threats, that's not a strategy. So I'm not going to go any more into SWOT analysis, but I'd recommend looking at a template or watching further videos or even pick up a book if you want to learn more. As with anything though, I would happily do a deep dive into SWOT analysis. Just give me a shout on social media or email will@marketingmadeclear.com if this is something you want to see. I'd also add that the Boston Consulting Group with the Growth Share Matrix can be a useful tool in strategic planning. This is used for plotting market growth rate against relative market share, and it helps you to categorize your product into one of four categories. But this tool would be better used for an established company, so I'm going to leave this one for now. Right. SWOT is in the bag. The next thing a good strategy needs, as I've already mentioned, is objectives. And even though these are likely to change, how are you supposed to know if your strategy or plan is a success without some form of target or objective? So although a strategy might put more emphasis on what a company is going to do to reach an objective, to me it would seem quite meaningless unless the objective was fairly clear. So I'd highly recommend making sure that objectives are refined. And yes, there's the whole SMART objective thing that is specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and time-based. I think that's all fairly self-explanatory, and I'm sure you've heard it all before. But if you want me to do another deep dive on SMART objectives, let me know. I'm happy to do that. But often marketing objectives will come from the company's top-level objectives and perhaps vision or mission statement. As such, it will be quite important that whoever is leading the marketing of a company and setting marketing goals is engaged with the leaders of the company to align goals. And objectives should be hierarchical, and sometimes we have to prioritize one objective over another. They can be mutually exclusive. So some examples of marketing objectives include increasing share of voice, which we sometimes call SOV. That means to measure your advertising share or visibility compared to competitors. Or increasing brand awareness. So do a study, see how many people are aware of your product, run a campaign, do another study to see if it's changed. Improving brand perception, I think that's obvious. Boosting sales, obvious again. Acquire more users or customers, again, easy to measure that one. Generate more leads, again, easy to measure. But then we can look at the quality of leads as well. So it might be generate more quality leads, as an example. Increase customer lifetime value, so that's CLV, customer lifetime value. And that's looking kind of longer term over the type of customers that you're bringing in. Are they the best type? But to measure these, in most cases, you'll need to know the state of affairs before starting a campaign and then after the campaign is finished. So that's why you have to have that measurability as part of objectives. And that's kind of the point I want to make. I don't want to labour this too much, so we'll move on.
Wait a minute. Who you.
Marketing maker.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's get ready to rumble!
And now, the main event, I think, is value proposition. I feel like we've cut through a lot of different influences and aspects of strategy to get to this point. So I think this is the perfect time now to address what I think is the absolute crux of a strategy, and that is the value proposition. Sorry. The value proposition. That's better. And on this topic, I absolutely love the book Value Proposition Design, which is part of the Strategizer series by the books by Osterwalder and chums. And I love this series of books, honestly. Being dyslexic, I find the layout and the visuals so helpful. If I was to write a book, I'd love it to be half as good as these. I have no association whatsoever with these guys. I just really like their books. So in Value Proposition Design, that book by them, you're led through the process of developing value proposition, which they split into four stages: canvas, design, test, and evolve. But the basic premise is to provide you with tools that help you refine value proposition with that customer focus. But then, and this is the bit I really like, is keeping your value propositions aligned with the evolving set of customer demands. They see value proposition as non-linear. So by that, I mean they're not just a simple process, like a simple step-by-step, you've got your value proposition, then you're done. You might feel like you're going around in circles a bit, but that's okay. If you keep your strategy the same, but you keep looking at it, it means because your strategy is the correct one, and that's why you haven't changed it. But the Strategizer series of books put value proposition at the center of the business model, so they place a huge amount of emphasis on it. So despite being non-linear, they do show two periods of value proposition design. The first being invention stage, and this is where new value propositions are thought up and potentially mind mapped, like refined to ensure that they align with the customer wants and needs. The second stage is improvement, and this focuses on managing, measuring, challenging, improving, and renewing existing value propositions. So you invent the value proposition and then you improve it. But what does this value proposition actually look like? Well, the reason I mentioned USPs in relation to value propositions earlier is because a large part of this is uniqueness, or you could argue perceived uniqueness. Because if you can't offer anything unique, what reason is there for a customer to buy from you? And critically, how well does that proposition match customer demands? Playing devil's advocate,
I am the devil, and I am here to do the devil's work.
Do see plenty of Me Too companies whose position is a replication of another company, but those companies usually don't do as well as leading companies. And I feel like that puts them at the mercy of that leading company, if that makes sense. It's not like having control of your own destiny or just being an opportunist. A silly example is when the Beatles blew up in the 60s, record labels went crazy signing loads of bands from Liverpool, and a lot of these bands did okay, but none of them did as well as the Beatles, and I'd argue that many of them didn't do as well because they weren't as unique as the Beatles. But then again, not many bands were, or are. Your value proposition also needs to be something that you can consistently offer. Otherwise, what you're doing is placing an emphasis on something that you might not be able to offer your customers as consistently or long-term as a competitor. Like, can you imagine if you put all that effort into telling your customers how important it is to have the fastest car, and then somebody comes along and makes a faster one?
No way.
A unique value proposition usually comes in the form of a statement. It includes the unique benefit or advantage that that product provides, and this sets it apart from competitors. There are some great examples of unique value propositions, or UVP for short, and often the most memorable part of a UVP is the tagline. So, as an example, firstly, Apple.
Think different.
Apple's tagline, Think Different, emphasizes innovation, user-friendly design, and the premium experience that inspires creativity and individuality. This was introduced at a time when computers and other electronic devices were focusing on specifications. The market was saturated with companies shouting about how much memory and how much storage a computer had, whether the computer had the latest Intel chip, or they had the latest version of Microsoft. Apple disrupted the market by focusing on something completely different, which was creativity. And they still stick to that, despite the fact that they have a market-leading position now. Most of the industries that they compete in, they're the leaders. But they're still associated with creativity, and they dominate sectors like design, music production, and video. And then IKEA. Yeah, sorry, I'm using IKEA again. Sorry.
IKEA, the wonderful everyday.
IKEA's vision is to create a better everyday life for the many people, or the wonderful everyday, which is kind of apparent in the fact that they are the world's largest furniture retailer. They disrupted the market by searching for low-cost real estate in major cities, building a huge store with a restaurant and loads of parking, selling good quality furniture for a low cost that consumers can take home in their car because it comes flat-packed. They created a model which is incredibly hard to replicate, but consumers love it. And they offer such a wide range that they can cover everything from very cheap furniture for first-time buyers or students. But then they offer luxury bespoke kitchens and sleek, elegant furniture at a much higher price for the top-end consumers. Another example is Airbnb.
Airbnb, belong anywhere.
Airbnb used the proposition belong anywhere, which emphasizes the unique travel experiences and personalized accommodation. They connect travellers and local hosts, which is an authentic and memorable experience for travellers because it's off the beaten track. It appeals to consumers seeking immersive travel experiences. This comes like totally as a direct challenge to existing hotels. How can a hotel offer such an immersive experience? In fact, hotels almost offer the exact opposite. Hotels are usually marketed on having that safe space to stay. And being franchises, they set clear expectations with consumers, so they know what that hotel's going to be like. So if you book a Hilton, you know what to expect. If you book a Travelodge, you know what to expect. But if you book an Airbnb, you may not know what to expect. Opening up the potential new experience, but offering this on a safe platform, which takes care of payments and offers reviews and all sorts of other information about where you're going to stay. Another favourite example of mine is Harley Davidson.
Freedom for the soul.
So Harley Davidson's tagline is freedom for the soul. And this represents the social aspect of owning a motorcycle rather than focusing on the motorcycle itself. So whereas high performance motorcycles will focus on speed, acceleration, cornering, and the more technical aspects of the motorcycle, Harley Davidson firmly places the emphasis on social community. So that's the social community of bikers. And this can be interpreted by the consumer as a collective freedom for the social community of bikers, or it can be interpreted as more individual freedom for the individual consumer. Either way, it taps into an emotional driver rather than a rational driver. So hopefully from those four examples, you can kind of see some suggestions for successful strategies. But like I said earlier, it's important to adapt. Again, adapt or die. And I think that's becoming my motto. Will Green, adapt or die. But there are some examples of companies that haven't done it so well because they haven't adapted quick enough. And off the top of my head, in the music industry, it's the best example for me again. Record companies didn't react quick enough to consumers wanting to buy music online. Instead of inventing ways to sell music online, they invested in anti-piracy measures, people trying to stop people from being able to rip songs from CDs. And I saw this firsthand, honestly. So consumers had no other option but to use sites like Napster to download songs, which crippled the industry. Like nowadays, we stream music and there's a process in place for artists to receive royalties from these streams, but it's been a very tough process to get where we are today. The music industry still hasn't really recovered. This strategy, in hindsight, would be called protectionism. But you could also say that this was a refusal of accepting that their old strategies would no longer work. And I suppose that collectively they thought that the move to buy music online would go away, but it didn't. And another bad strategy we've already covered is just competing on price. And this tends to be known then as marketing shootouts.
Well, someone's gonna die.
At the end of the shootout, somebody's gonna be dead. Or in this case, one of the companies is gonna be out of business. But we could describe it as a race to the bottom as well. A middle of the road strategy is also never recommended. Because how can you be unique if you're in the middle of the road? And the companies in the middle of the road get run over.
Oh, and it was a f***ing cop! And it's on my dash cam! What?
And finally, believing that if it ain't broke, don't fix it, it just brings me back to that need to adapt. And you need to constantly look at the changing environment and changing consumer demands, because you'll get left behind otherwise. All right, let's take another breather. It's a big episode, there's a lot to cover, and I totally get it. If you're feeling quite overwhelmed by this, don't worry, you know. I really think that when we go to deep dives on other episodes, we'll come back to this, and this might make a lot more sense later. So if this is not kind of marketing made clear and marketing made confusing, I'm really sorry. But it will hopefully make sense once you learn a little bit more in other episodes. I really wanted to kind of approach marketing and marketing strategy as the first two episodes, because it's so important for the rest of the understanding. So if you can take anything from this episode, maybe it's something you can come back to later. But we're going to keep going. We've got some questions and all sorts that I'm going to answer. And let's hope that it won't be kind of a brain fryer. I'm really hoping that this is going to help. So the next bit we're going to go into is tips for creating a value proposition and for strategy. So I'd like to give you a few tips that I've learned along the way, whether this be from experience or through research. And firstly, I think that I'm sure I've made this quite clear already, but to be able to test your value proposition, you really need to have a good understanding of your customer. So I would recommend creating a customer profile, or ideally many customer profiles that represent your key segment or segments. What you can then do is list your USPs on your values, and you can connect them with those customer profiles. And we tend to call this value mapping. By relating these and connecting your USPs with your target customers, you'll naturally end up describing how you intend to create value for that customer. So that works really well. And also, creating profiles can be quite fun. And I always like to give them different names and add information that is a little bit over the top, but that's just me. The Strategizer series that I was talking about earlier with Osterwalder and all, they describe customer needs as jobs, which is a kind of different way of looking at it. But these are things that your customer is trying to get done in their life. So we can look at this from problems that they're trying to solve or needs that they're trying to satisfy. And then they also identify pain points for customers. So this is anything that annoys your customer before, during, or after trying to get a job done. And finally, they identify gains, which are outcomes and benefits that your customer actually wants. If you can identify all of these things for your customer, either by doing research or through your own knowledge, but applying this to a customer profile, you can rank the importance of these and prioritize the values for each group. So the reason I think this is so important is that you can really apply this to your communications and advertising. So when you're creating an advert for a particular customer in mind, you'll have worked out the most important things to communicate for that advert or whatever you're doing. So by using a value proposition, you have outlined a clear strategy. I'm going to use IKEA again, sorry. But with IKEA, earlier I said about clear different customer groups that you'd have. One group was students. And so IKEA can leverage the cheap furniture that they have, like tables and chairs. And when communicating to that customer group, they know that these products are going to be their biggest winners. They might even focus on the weight of products because they know that some students don't have cars and they'll need to carry their stuff home, or even low home delivery costs or something like that. For the high-end customers, they would focus on the design service that they offer, so kitchen planning and installation services. So in fact, a far less of a focus on products, but more of a service focus. They'd also focus on the design with far less focus on price. And IKEA may have a different customer profile for a student that would include all sorts of information about what kind of social media they use, what kind of time they're online. They might even have something like the fact that they're more likely to come and eat a bunch of meatballs while visiting IKEA. So a strategy that offers 50% off meatballs for a dinner might work really well to get people into the store. They might give that customer group a name like Sammy the Student or something like that. They'd include all sorts of information like where they live, what their age is, and all sorts of stuff like that. With the high-end customer, they might call that Sally from the Valley or something silly like that. And that would have all sorts of demographic information again, what kind of media they're watching and what shows they're watching. If they want to place an advert on TV for them, they might do that. And it might also include something like they're highly driven by delivery-based office, or again, something related to service. But how could you possibly target each of these groups without an idea and a profile of them and a clear strategy for each of them? So hopefully that makes it a little bit clearer, but I do understand that without being able to visually show you some of these tools, it might take a little bit of an imagination to understand. And just finally, another recommendation that I've come across is that Google offers some really good training courses for marketers, which is completely free to access. And on the training platform, they recommend that the sweet spot for a value proposition or strategy is where a company has found a way to communicate with customers in a way that's both engaging but propels the interest of the company forward. Google recommends customer-first marketing, emphasizing the need for brands to understand the market, understand their potential customers, and then drive towards a brand mission and identity that truly serves what customers want and adds value to their lives. And Google practically owns the internet now. So if digital is part of your strategy, I would certainly take note of what they're saying. So I think the recommendations are fairly consistent and clear wherever you look. Just focus on the customer. Hopefully that's provided some food for thought and inspired you to look a little bit more at practically applying value proposition creation. Now, I've just thought we totally neglected to talk about trends. And for this, I can only apologize.
Oh my God, that is so trendy. I love it.
Activating trends.
Trends now online. Welcome, Mr. Green.
So I'm going to buck the trend, excuse the pun, and instead of looking at trends on Google, I'm going to talk about a few of the trends that Philip Kotler puts forward in his book, Marketing Insights from A to Z. Oh my God, I said A to Z. A to Z, sorry. Kotler puts forward 9 trends in marketing that you should be aware of.
1.
Number 1, moving from make and sell marketing to sense and respond marketing. Yep, so the basic premise here is that your company will do better if you view marketing as a way to generate a better understanding of your customer needs rather than just pushing the products.
2.
Number 2, moving from focusing on customer attraction to focusing on customer retention. Absolutely, but I know you have to focus on both. But I get that the argument here is about not neglecting your current customers. I mean, how many times do we feel hard done by when we see a great new customer offer from a company you already buy from, but you don't get any benefit of that because you're already a customer? And so you just feel like it's better to go and go to another company and then you'll get the new customer offer if you come back.
3.
Number 3 is moving from pursuing market share to pursuing customer share. So the idea here is a growing basket size. And this means trying to get your customers to buy more from you or upselling. And this is important, but again, you shouldn't neglect any area of customer acquisition or retention. We've got to number 3 here, but this reminds me of Mystery Men, the mystic guy on that a little bit.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions.
Anyway, number 4.
4.
Is moving from marketing monologue to customer dialogue. This is basically a nod to relationship marketing, which we'll cover in a future episode.
5.
Number 5, moving from mass marketing to customized marketing. Absolutely. And this goes back to moving away from scattergun marketing to more targeted marketing. And this links to what I've been saying about understanding your customer.
6.
Number 6 is moving from owning assets to owning brands. And what I think Kotler means here is to keep a focus on growing your brand rather than just making and selling products. At the end of the day, your brand equity is what will allow you to charge more than just the cost price for your goods.
7.
Number 7 is moving from operating in the marketplace to operating in cyberspace. And this is a bit cringe, but hopefully by the fact that you're listening to this podcast, you're not ignoring the opportunities that come with digital platforms. But this just serves as a warning to those that might neglect the online marketplace.
8.
Number 8 is moving from single channel marketing to multi-channel marketing. And it's been proven time and time again that using a multi-channel approach is far more effective than just using one channel. So if you're doing really well just using Facebook ads or just placing an advert in your local newspaper, or if your whole business relies on TikTok, that's great. But you could lead a far more effective campaign if you're also utilizing other media channels that your target market are also engaged with. It's also very risky to put your eggs in one basket. And if that channel changes, something that it most likely will, that could jeopardize your whole business. Companies have gone out of business because they rely on Instagram. And Instagram changes, doesn't work anymore, they lose all the customers and they go out of business.
9.
And finally, number 9. Moving from product-centric marketing to customer-centric marketing. And yes, this is something that I've mentioned quite a lot in this episode, but this is really important to have a focus on your customers. And hopefully I've given you a couple of tips and tools for how to do that. And that's it for trends. It's super quick this time. Let's cover some of the questions that I mentioned in the intro to this episode.
I love it.
We'll create the marketing strategy and we involved in the strategy.
What?
We'll create the marketing strategy and we involved in the strategy.
Oh, who creates the marketing strategy and who is involved in the strategy?
Oui, monsieur.
Sorry, you kind of threw me with the involved there.
Je suis désolé.
Why are you suddenly speaking French anyway?
Va va voom.
Okay. Who creates the marketing strategy and who's involved in the strategy?
Oui, monsieur.
Well, I guess anyone can create a marketing strategy, but it really comes down to then putting that strategy into practice. And a company won't put a strategy into practice if it doesn't have the backing of the person or people responsible for making the strategic marketing decisions for a company. That being said, it also won't get put into practice if people in the organisation that implement the marketing activities aren't also engaged or informed about the strategy. So as a general rule, the person who is responsible for marketing in an organisation will also lead the development of the marketing strategy. But they may delegate the responsibilities for creating the strategy to other people within the organisation. The creation of a marketing strategy typically involves the collaboration and input from various stakeholders, so specific roles and responsibilities may vary depending on a company's size, structure and the industry. But in larger companies, it's usually the chief marketing officer or CMO or marketing director that will lead the development of this marketing strategy. They're responsible for setting the overall marketing objectives, aligning strategies with business goals, and ensuring the effective implementation of marketing initiatives. And then the marketing team, the wider team that is, including managers and specialists, contribute their expertise to form the different areas of the strategy. So as an example, a market researcher within the company may form the segments and custom profiles that we're talking about, whereas the digital marketing manager would then select the digital channels that are chosen in order to reach those customers. All of this will be fed up to the marketing director in order to flesh out that strategy. In a large company, strategy is usually championed by the executive leadership team within that organisation. So I'd expect that the CMO or marketing director would already present the marketing strategy to the executive leadership team and gain their support before the strategy reaches the wider company or the marketing department. I should also acknowledge the role that external consultants and agencies play, especially for smaller companies who don't have the same level of expertise within their own workforce. The marketing strategy may even include some direction as to how external consultants and agencies will be utilised to reach the objectives of the strategy. So in summary, the creation of a marketing strategy is usually a collaborative effort, but then it's the job of the person leading the marketing to make sure that it's then put into practice in the way that it should be.
What elements should a marketing strategy cover?
Pardon, madame?
What elements should a marketing strategy cover?
Ah oui, what elements should a marketing strategy cover?
Un petit peu.
Well, this will probably recap most of what we've already covered, but the key elements of a marketing strategy typically include target market identification, so defining the specific audience or customer segment that the business aims to reach, or that could be multiple segments as we looked at with IKEA. This includes understanding the demographics, behaviours, preferences and needs. Then we talked about the unique value proposition or UVP. So as we've said, articulating what sets the business apart from competitors and why customers should choose its products and services over alternatives. Then the marketing mix. So some steer as to the marketing channels that will be used. That includes all the 7 P's with product, price, place, promotion, people, process and physical evidence. But in a later episode, I'm going to take you through the PESO model. P-E-S-O, that is, which will give you a very good grounding and new perspective on marketing channels, I hope, anyway.
Mon petit citroën.
And then market research. That's gathering and analysing data about the market, environment, industry trends, competitors and consumer insights to inform strategic decisions. I introduced you to this in the context of a SWOT analysis, but other frameworks work great too. Then objectives. I talked about SMART objectives and goals. Again, how do you know if you've been successful if you haven't got an objective or a goal? But key performance indicators, or KPIs for short, are very common to be used here and show if, one, you're on track to achieve a goal, or two, if you have actually reached that goal. And it's only by doing this if you can evaluate the success of the strategy. But there's some other areas that I haven't discussed, and these include budget allocation. This includes the allocation of resources, whether it be financial, human, time, or even product to give away, and how much of each of these you want to give away to various marketing activities based on their potential impact and return on investment, ROI. And then implementation plan. So this is a plan that deals with things like the timeline, milestones, and responsibilities and actions required to execute the marketing strategy effectively. A well-crafted marketing strategy provides a roadmap for businesses to navigate the competitive landscape, capitalize on opportunities, mitigate risks, and achieve sustainable growth by effectively connecting with and satisfying customer needs and wants. It should be dynamic, adaptable, and it should allow for adjustments based on market changes, consumer feedback, and performance analytics. Now, I could have said all of that at the beginning, but hopefully by sticking with me through all of my ramblings, that made way more sense than if you went in cold, right? Please?
Sérieusement, Guillaume. Savez-vous de quoi vous parlez ici? Où dois-je appeler mon ami Philippe Kotler?
Oui, je sais de quoi je parle. Maintenant, silence.
Oh là là.
Où je parlerai de votre conduit à Philippe Kotler.
Ok. But please, William, I must ask you this. What does a marketing strategy actually look like?
So what does a marketing strategy actually look like?
Oui, monsieur.
So a marketing strategy may be presented in the form of a document or a Word document or PowerPoint presentation. It doesn't particularly matter how it's presented. It's more about the substance or the actual strategy. The strategy should be presented in a way that makes it most clear to the stakeholders who will be putting it into practice, and maybe if you need buy-in from investors or something. So if we're talking about a small company, then a PowerPoint presentation or slide deck is probably fine. But if we're talking about a large organization, then the strategy may need to be kind of much more refined as a policy document or full piece of printed media. It would then be up to the marketing leadership team or individual to cascade that strategy throughout the organization. This is almost like a marketing campaign in itself, but inside a company. So it's important for the right channels to be chosen, even the right visual aids. So personally, I love to use way more illustrative ways of conveying a strategy. I'm a big fan of visualizing a marketing funnel, moving through the stages of reach, engagement, conversion, and retention of customers, using a model that you can show what type of marketing channels are going to be used at which stage, and show the relationship between each activity. For example, in the reach stage, I would classify Facebook ads as trying to reach a potential customer and what the key takeaways would be for them to understand the very top level proposition of the company. And then I'd show that these people would be then re-engaged through Facebook on a second type of advert that actually gets people onto the website and really engages with them. And then most of the website activity would be geared towards converting a customer. And most of the email activity would be geared towards retaining and re-engaging existing customers. In my visualization that I use, the reach, engagement, conversion, and retention moves from left to right. And I usually illustrate that the consumer moves from left to right. They go from the least qualified type of potential customer to being the most qualified and then an actual customer. And then finally, a loyal customer or a repeat customer. In this visualization, I add in all sorts of details, such as feedback loops to stop customers from disengaging with the company and all sorts of bits of detail. So creating something like this takes a lot of effort, but I always find it worthwhile because it creates a clear reference for people in my department to then refer to.
Je suis désolé.
Look, don't be upset.
Okay.
It's just been a long episode and I think you're a little bit cranky.
Okay.
You can't just threaten to phone Philip Kotler on me all the time, okay?
Okay. Va va voom. How do you change your marketing strategy?
Next question is, how do you change your marketing strategy?
Yes, that is what he said, silly man.
I'm going to ignore that. So changing your marketing strategy is something that you wouldn't take lightly, I'm sure. I'd imagine in most scenarios, a change of strategy is due to poor performance. But you may also want to change strategy due to an opportunity or threat. Take Levi Jeans. Let me take you back to the Wild Wild West. In the mid-1800s, Levi Strauss was a dry goods wholesale business in New York. But Levi emigrated to San Francisco during the gold rush. He opened his own dry goods business to serve small general stores of the American West. But they had a surplus of this tough fabric that they tended to use for stuff like tents. And after suffering from a lack of business, Levi diversified and saw a market opportunity. Because people working in the gold rush, it's hard work, you know, and they're wearing their trousers out really quickly. So they developed this tent material, otherwise known as denim, into a durable work trouser, or pants in America, stitched with a heavy stitch and riveted with metal rivets and metal buttons. And that's how they became the company we know today. The rest is history. That's quite a severe change in strategy. But like I said earlier, economic downturns mean that some companies have to move from premium offerings to affordable offerings. And sometimes things that customers care about are no longer important. So a new strategy has to be selected. Changing your marketing strategy is a lot like forming the marketing strategy in the first place. You have to set new objectives, new customer segments maybe. But the difference is that you are an implementer of change. You have to measure where you're moving from as well as where you're trying to move to. So it's the same thing about objectives and doing your research as we're talking about when you're kind of developing a new strategy. But you're probably a lot more sure of your current position. Well, it's been a bit of a beast of an episode. Thanks for sticking with me, and I'm sure it was an emotional rollercoaster for you, as it was for me. There's no haters and heroes today, sorry. Most of the information has come from books, so I didn't come across anything really for that section. But in the next episode, well, I'm sure that will probably unearth a few gems. I want to give a nod to some of the books that have inspired this episode, notably Marketing Insights from A to Z, or A to Z, by Philip Kotler, Ashok Ranshaw's Marketing Strategies, which was a book I used a lot at university too, Strategic Marketing Planning by Gilligan and Wilson, and there's many other books that have always contributed to my research, so, you know, I will give a shout out to books in most of the episodes. But that's it. Thanks for joining me. I hope this has got you in the mood to learn a bit more marketing. In the next episode, we'll be covering why do people hate marketers? It's going to be a little bit more lighthearted in times, but there's some really serious parts as well. But I think it will provide a change after a couple of heavier episodes on the theory side of things. As always, to support the podcast, please do subscribe and check out my website, marketingmadeclear.com. If you'd like to suggest topics, correct anything I missed up, or just drop me a line, email info@marketingmadeclear.com. And please follow Marketing Made Clear on Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram. Much love and good night. Helping you to elevate from beginner to a pro, ain't a better way. Marketing Made Clear, it's showtime. Wanna see you win, wanna see you shine.
Let's go. Are you ready? For the thousands in attendance and the millions watching around the world.
Welcome to Thought Live. Oh my God, that's good advice.